Hi, this is Polly Myers, and I have Josh Myers with me.
Hello, everyone.
Today is Thursday, October. No, it's not. Josh
Friday.
Had to fly yesterday, and so we delayed the call a day, so you might be a little bit confused. This is normally it is the first Thursday of every month and the third Tuesday of every month that we do the free Q&A call, but Josh had to fly yesterday, which is one of the things that none of us could do for a while. So he flew in and is having a good time in a new city, and he can talk to you about that. So if anybody has a question, you just press the button star and number 2, and that will raise a little flag to me, and I'll see you, and then we'll get you on as soon as we can and answer your questions. But we understand that a lot of you guys do not like to put yourself out there. You're nervous. You think this is a mental illness, which we're going to teach you it's not, and that you should be ashamed of this, so you tend to stay back and not say anything. So, Josh, do you have anything to say before we get started?
Oh, it's neat that, you know, I'm able to get on a commercial airliner and fly to Dallas, by the way, is where I'm at right now. I live in Salt Lake City. And it's about 2 hours, not too big of a deal. And then I rode their DART system here, which is a light rail system. It was about an hour from the airport into downtown. Lots of homeless people. It was an interesting trip. There was a schizophrenic sitting behind my wife, which was a little unnerving. But,
well, that was interesting.
Cursing and spitting on the floor and all the fun stuff that comes with public transportation. But you focus on those elements, right, rather than just my inability.
Would rather not trade places with that person. Just to remind you that if you have a question or a comment, star 2, and we will get to you as soon as I see it and we finish up whatever question we're on, we'll get to people. Again, we know that it's uncomfortable for a lot of you to talk in public or on the phone, so that's okay. You can just sit there and listen. I was just telling Josh that we had 2 fabulous, fabulous love calls this week already, and I was hoping one of them would be on the phone. Actually, one of them can't be on until the evening call, but one of them is in South Africa, and this lady is big in government, interestingly, in South Africa, and she's been doing the program maybe for a year, and she was really stuck. She was really in a lot of trouble, and both her sons have anxiety, one of which was actually stuck in his bedroom when we first started this. Anyway, she couldn't drive. She couldn't do a lot of things, and then she started practicing and did some pretty spectacular things, and then her other son decided that he wanted to go to Italy, and he could afford to take one of his parents, so he took her.
Wow.
And she flew 28 hours. She, now catch this, she rode on a bus with 49 other people for 10 days.
Wow.
Now, I'm not brave enough to try that. And she said when she got home, she was so excited, and she just, the email was, thank you, you know, you gave me my life back. And so that was really fun. The other one was from a guy who could not drive a year ago, roughly a year ago. He started on a program. We had some consultations. I think Josh spoke with them. And his work wanted him to do a lot more things than he was doing. And he just couldn't face anything, and barely could get to work. And he called me and he said, I'm going on this trip. The company is telling me that I need to set up a new business in Arizona. And I think, like I said, he's from Ohio. And he said, I've got to set it up. I've got to train these people. And I think I'm ready. I think I can do this. So he called me back after he got home. He was there for 2 weeks, and he set the whole business up, and he taught from stage all these people. He drove, he flew, all the things he hadn't done for so long, and now they want him to train internationally. So he and Josh are probably going to have to work on going through customs. That's his hang-up. But the one thing that's really exciting is he's ready to have someone else come into his life. He has never let someone come in as a partner because of his anxiety, and now he feels like he's ready to open himself up to him. So, I mean, gosh, does that make the life worthwhile or not, what we do worthwhile?
Yeah, you know, listening to those stories, first of all, you
wasn't
know,
that
hearing
fantastic?
About, it's fun, and it is why I do what I do. You know, I getting calls like that is, yeah, you can't put a price on that. We all talk about what would it be like to save someone's life, and I think both my mom and I have done it many times. And it's weird, intense to get those phone calls. And then we just press ahead and, you know, it's not like we stop doing what we're doing because we've done that.
The excitement is just, I love, and then they keep giving me these stories and I did this. I get these little messages. I did this and I did that. They're so proud and I'm so proud. So it's just, it keeps me going when I first start working with somebody and it's really tough and they're really down. And then I get those stories and, you know, I have to admit, I'm still not ready to go on a bus with 49 people for 10 days.
You know,
but, you know.
It's okay. You know, my standard is if it's something I would absolutely love to do with or without anxiety, I do it. I push forward and learn how to do it. And I know for me, cruise ships just, you know, it's not something I would do. Las Vegas isn't a huge attraction for me.
Had a panic, a big one there when you were a little boy.
I've had many panic attacks.
Everywhere.
Vegas. But, you know, when I look back on it, if the question was, if I love something about Las Vegas, I would go ahead and and work through that. But actually, it's really neat to be in a place with anxiety where I can ask the question, like, is this something I would enjoy doing with or without anxiety? The anxiety is so quiet. I can actually ask that question for the first time.
Right.
There are people that I might not choose to be around with or without anxiety, even though they might induce some anxiety. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And once I realize, you know, I don't want this person in my life, or I do want to do the work to have this experience. I live the life I want to. Going back to the very first concept, I just want to let people know how often we hear the story of mom, son, sister, brother. You know, genetics comes up a lot in our teaching, and it happens so often that in our interactions with people, we see sort of validation of this perspective. Some kids within the family have no trouble, but
You have two.
Yeah.
You have one yes, one no.
Oh, in my family, we'll see. Right, they're 10 and 13 at this point. One's a definite yes, but doing really, really well. With that, I think we're doing, you know, it's neat to be coaching somebody right from the very beginning with their first experiences with anxiety. And we've already had some things that he couldn't do for a while, but now those are back. He can do them 100%. And we talk openly about it. And
I know, and
so
you
we'll
left
see.
Him alone for this trip.
Yeah, and I don't let my experiences, the fact that that would have been hard for me at his age, I don't let that kind of bleed out. I don't let that kind of be a feature. I don't limit him based on what was hard for me.
Right.
I address his challenges as they come up, and we put them away. We come up with tools and strategies just like I would for anybody else. But, yeah, we're gone. He's having a blast with, in this case, a grandma. And he had no school today. That was a surprise. These teachers, they get all these days off, I'm realizing. And sometimes I don't catch all the ones coming. So she thought she was going to have a free day, no kids today, while they were in school. And so he's alone with grandma, and we got some pictures of them going for a walk with our dog. So he's having
not
a blast.
He's getting a special time. Well, let's get to the questions because, I have four pages here, and you know we're not going to get through them. So
I just want to let people know that if you're not comfortable sharing your questions today publicly on the phone, that's fine. We're always receptive to getting those questions after the fact, and that turns into what we're getting right now. So that's
and oftentimes
fine.
We respond before if the
true. We don't need
big time.
Yeah, we don't need to wait a couple of weeks to get back to important questions. Both Noam and I were very interested in getting people on the right track as quickly as possible.
Okay, ready?
Okay,
set?
I am.
Okay, anyone have any tips for anxiety on bridges? Bridges, overpasses, and interstate ramps with out guardrails freak me out.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried distracting myself, playing on my phone, and just closing my eyes, but I'm curious what has worked for others. Thanks. And by the way, again, I'm going to tell you that if you have a question, we'll have a break in between these questions, so just star 2, and your hand will raise up. I'll see it, and I'll answer. Okay.
Okay.
So, sorry, Bridges. I broke your concentration.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Bridges are common. Just, you know, step 1, know that you're not alone. Bridges get people all the time. There's a sense of being kind of committed or stuck. Bridges, escalators, elevators.
Oh, you know what? I don't think I muted everybody. How do I do that, Josh?
Up top, you'll go to a mode that is
wait a minute. Okay, I muted the people that have come on individually.
Okay. I have my computer screen up as well, and I can monitor this, but I'm here in Dallas on my phone.
Well, they changed the system a little bit, so okay.
Okay,
the noises are gone, so okay, sorry about
that. Bridges are common, and there's some reasons for that, right? You know, bridges are the height. They trigger some other feelings of being trapped and of being high, you know, in danger. This is normal. Everybody, I think, at some level, if they looked over the side of a bridge, would get kind of that experience. So it kind of has that tendency to trigger on its own. Like, if anxiety is going to show up, it's a place where, even without anxiety, you might get a tingle of anxiety. So for some reason, you know, it started in your life, and it's reinforced. There's kind of 2 ways to go. We always have the choice with anxiety about something specific, where we can tackle it as a specific thing. We can say, okay, I'm going to go find a bridge that I can walk on over a small river or a freeway, and we can minimize the challenge down to something manageable. And your brain might say, oh, this is nothing like the problem, but go ahead and do it. And get to where you go over that bridge, and you time it maybe. You go, okay, that's 30 seconds. And driving over that, the one that bugs me is actually less time, or maybe the same time. And we can start to challenge by progressive exposure the idea of a specific phobia. And in that, we can learn a bit about ourselves. What do our thoughts look like? What is it about it? What is it about? You can hear in the question the idea that it doesn't have a guardrail or that there's something realistically dangerous about it. And that's kind of getting into the second part of this, which is we kind of randomly choose things to have our anxiety around. You know, the actual threat of driving over a bridge is very low. And somebody who has a difficulty driving over a bridge might look at somebody who can't ride on an escalator, even though they're incredibly closely related, and go, what are you talking about? You can't die on an escalator. And the escalator person says, that's nothing to do about dying. It's about my panic. And my panic is triggered by an escalator. And for this person, it's a bridge. And this, we start to get kind of deeper into the idea that, look, we assign a connection that isn't real all the time. And we rationalize it like crazy. Air travel is a really common one. Oh, airplanes, you know, 30,000 feet, 500 miles an hour. You know, we see the occasional accidents. Well, we know it's one of the safest ways of traveling on the planet. But once our anxiety is connected to that, we've got to slowly break it and acknowledge that we're the source of anxiety, not the bridge, not the escalator, and not the airplane. And that's a longer fight. That's a longer one. And over time, I encourage most people to challenge the bigger picture. But once in a while, people have this one very specific thing, and we work them through. And they may call me again if their anxiety has been attached to something else down the road. But we do it, just like I described, by picking a small enough challenge with just enough to induce that that initial anxiety, and we get to where that's normal. For some people, it's driving, and for some reason, 2-3 miles from their house, they're fine, but there's this magic border at 4 or 5 or 6 miles where all of a sudden it goes from no big deal to a very big deal, and we just want to touch that and turn around, and touch it and turn around, touch it and turn around, to the point where that sort of ring of what we can experience grows. And I always describe it like a ratchet, that we are always going to keep progressing in one direction. We only can move in one direction, which is to grow our lives back out. But in the moment, we're the opposite. We're extremely flexible. If we need to pull over, take a break, the idea is I can give myself any permission I need today to take as much time, as much whatever, I need to make this as easy as possible. But big picture, I'm moving forward. I'm only moving forward. If I have a bad day today, I don't feel like I've progressed, prepare to be surprised that tomorrow, when you try again, you might actually do really well after a, quote, bad day. That happens all the time. So steadily we march towards our goals. And it's difficult, and it takes discipline and repetition. And I think people who work with me can quickly understand that I've been there, which gives me, you know, the ability to communicate in language that really helps them understand what it's like and what getting through it's going to look like. And also I think I have the authority to tell them when it's time that this isn't easy. You know, some of this stuff just takes some repetitive discomfort to undo, but it's worth it. And they usually believe me and go.
Usually and, believe you. Well, I think the fact that both of us have just really been in the gutter and that we've done exactly what you're telling them to do, is it helps them know that, yeah, okay, he did it, so he's leading me. Plus, you have a lot of training. Are you ready for another question?
Not quite. I just want to end on the idea. There's a lot of stuff that will go on sort of that we're not talking about in this question to kind of what I call rebuild your batteries, and that's really where the Breakthrough Program comes in. There's a lot of stuff I do sort of behind the scenes, away from the moment of crossing the bridge or whatever happens to be the challenge, where we're making the process just a lot easier, where we're physiologically changing the people we work with so that that event happens. It's hard to explain. You've built up a reserve where those feelings don't hit you as hard. They don't last as long. And, boy, it makes such a huge difference in terms of how fast people are able to.
I found for me, once I went through the protocol, that originally I had what I call a trigger happy adrenal.
Right.
So all day long, I could be startled even just by a movement or anything, you know. So it was hyperactive. And then once I got on the protocol, my whole body started calming down. And so the adrenals started healing, and I just didn't over-respond. And then that's when I was able to practice. Before that, I don't care what anybody did. I would try to practice, and I would try to do the things they said, but I'd find myself right back in the square one and feeling terrible about myself. So,
yeah.
You know, anyway, been there, done that.
Yeah,
okay.
The way I describe it is before, you know, like you were just saying, that, you know, one event might produce a day long or 2 days of elevated anxiety.
Oh, I did a month at least.
Yeah, whereas when you've gotten your body through the Breakthrough Program kind of back to where it can be, the bridge might still induce something, but you might be really 100% recovered, and I'm not joking about that, 100% recovered in 5 minutes after a one-minute crossing of a bridge in a car, a couple deep breaths, turn around. And before, people are telling you, maybe a psychologist is telling you, oh, you just have to go over it and over it and over it, and it'll steadily get better and better and better. But that's just not true if your body's in a certain place. Whereas if you can completely recover in 5 minutes, you can turn around and go back over the bridge, take 5 minutes, turn around, go back over the bridge. Man, progress can happen so quickly. A couple of days of doing that, and it might be gone from your life forever. I always use the word tipping point. Being able to kind of change your physiology to the point where you're growing day by day, your limits are expanding day by day, versus the opposite, where our limits are coming in, and our lives are being more and more constricted. It's not like we come up with this one big thing that absolutely changes everything. It's just getting our bodies into this tipping point place where all of a sudden our lives start growing again, and boy, do they. So it's a wonderful process to be a part of.
Yeah.
And it requires the Breakthrough Program. I haven't been able to pull it off.
I know. You keep talking about it. Well,
it's
true.
It's true.
I just
credit where credit's
won't
due.
Live without it, and I know your family won't either. So
it's funny, yeah. Even the non-anxiety sufferers and the family still take much of it to get a better night's sleep and just feel more muscle relaxation and mind relaxation. So, yes, we have plenty of users, even in my family.
Okay. We're ready. Let's see. So everybody knows, if you have a question or a comment, just star 2. We're going to go on to the next question. Have been dealing with anxiety for 4 years now. I finally chose to take medicine and am almost back to my old self. Other than I get hot or sweaty, I always think I'm going to pass out. I have never passed out, and I don't know why this happens. People say how much better they feel when they work out. Here I am trying to do that, and my passing out freak out always makes me stop. Am I the only one this happens to?
No, I've heard that story many, many times. I actually view this as encouraging. What in a perfect world, exercise is an important thing. And then oftentimes I'm using exercise and diet, the breakthrough program, all that stuff to get people ready to go out and be successful with their practicing like we were talking about. But it's funny when exercise is the trigger. And like many things with anxiety, there's a balance between how difficult a thing is and how much reward or growth you'll experience with it. And I run into people all the time that it could be breathing is their issue, heart is their issue, a sense of passing out, to where exercise induces the sensations that are likely to produce anxiety in them. And so lucky them, they get to do the thing that was going to improve their overall mood and get them ready to practice and grow and all that stuff, and at the same time be practicing, be actually doing the thing that's inducing the anxiety. So, yes, it's hard. Yes, it's hard to get started if this is the case, but we can walk up to that slowly. We can have these short liver intervals where we elevate our heart rate and we start to challenge that catastrophic thinking. The idea that you're going to pass out is a classic anxiety catastrophic thought. If you spend any time on these phone calls, you'll hear a bunch of different versions of that thinking. But in this case, yours is the fear of passing out. Now, you could ask yourself, what is so horrible about passing out? You could challenge the idea of what is so actually catastrophic about that. And I can tell you that this is all part of the fight or flight response, and it wouldn't be a very effective response if it actually made you pass out. You know, if it was time to escape from the bear or fight the person in the alleyway for your life, which is what this system is designed to do, if your first response was just to pass out, that wouldn't be very evolutionarily adaptive. For the thousands of people we work with that have this as a concern, people don't pass out. So take my word on that. Pass out yourself. You can exercise and progressively push harder. But likewise, there'll be a tipping point in this person's process where you're finally able to exercise, get your heart rate up there, maybe even go all the way to your maximum heart rate, which is literally a maximum. Your body has this amazing governor built into it, and whatever your number is pretty much your number. It depends on your sex, your heart rate, your sex and age mostly, a little bit of genetics. And for me right now, it's about 191 beats per minute, and it slowly goes down as we get older to protect ourselves. It's an amazing process that we have this literal built-in electrochemical governor that prevents our heart from hurting itself by pushing too hard. And it's a hard and fast limit. I can go and push it. And as long as I'm not, you know, doing drugs, like illegal drugs, or I suppose prescription amphetamines would do it, that number is a fixed number. And it takes a little bit of time to realize that this mechanism is designed to save your life. This mechanism, the fight or flight response, and these other mechanisms that are built on top of it, like a maximum heart rate, that absolutely prevent you from having these experiences, what you're worried about, passing out, heart attack, whatever it is that people fear. And I find it personally fascinating. The more I stopped and learned about this process and about how amazingly refined my body was at allowing me to survive these extreme experiences and allow me to push myself and not pass out, you know, not hurt myself physiologically, it definitely gave me the confidence to be able to go do these things. And I teach this all the time. A little bit of learning about what's actually going on in your body can turn off these fears pretty quickly. So that's what I end up doing all the time, is kind of teaching people some basic physiology about their body. And often it takes it away. They realize they literally cannot pass out no matter what they do.
Well, actually, you have a appreciation for your body when you learn how incredible it is. Go ahead.
Oh, well, we have this hate relationship. We start off with this hate relationship with anxiety, and that certainly changed in me as I learned about it. I realized how amazing this process is. how complicated, multifaceted, millions of years of evolution and design go into it. It's unique to mammals. Other animals have different versions of it, but not like mammals do. And it's just it's a fascinating thing, and oftentimes when we have things that we're afraid of, as we learn about them, we take them out of this place of being just phobia, fear, and we kind of shift into a place of appreciation, wonder, fascination, and that's what happened with me. I'm amazed by what my body's able to do. And I've been in life and death situations, and I've done phenomenally well. I actually appreciate all the, not just the fact that my body has this stronger than average response to life and death situations, but I've had the exposure to it, and I'm able to manage myself in the middle of all that chemistry and take full advantage of all the benefits, but not get hammered with any actual panic. And that might sound counterintuitive for a person with anxiety disorder to say, I actually perform much better than other people when life and death is actually on the line. But I've experienced enough times to know that that's exactly what it is. I do amazingly well, and many of my clients have had those moments, and they're surprised to remember how well they did. And if other people were around, how much better they did than other people. So, yeah, over time, we actually can go from a place of kind of hatred towards this disorder and all of a sudden realize that we're just gifted. Just we have to learn how to take advantage of those gifts and not get kind of overwhelmed by them.
Okay, are you ready?
Sure.
Okay. I have now suffered with anxiety for about 3 years, which has worsened lately after giving birth to my son. My partner has suffered from alcoholism, and I am finding it very difficult to cope. I am anxious and on edge all the time, almost waiting for something to go wrong. I don't want to feel this way, but don't know what to do to start. I feel trapped in my own mind sometimes, always trying to control what he does and what he doesn't do. I probably am not helping his situation by being so anxious and controlling all the time. Please help. Oh, she's taking his burden on, right?
Yeah. Okay, let's just focus on one element of that. I mean, let's go quickly over the anxiety. You know, suffering from generalized anxiety is, you know, there's a ton of education, information surrounding the Break Free program. You know, look into it. The Break Free program is custom tailored for people with this kind of description of their anxiety. Generalized anxiety, there's a lot we can do. That being said, let's just focus on the alcohol question, because that hasn't really come up much in our conversation.
No, it hasn't.
Alcoholism often finds its way in the periphery of anxiety. And what I mean by that is there's kind of two groups of people. There's people who have family members who have chosen alcohol and alcoholism as a coping mechanism for their anxiety. So we can say definitively things like that, that people who were raised in environments with alcoholic parents are more likely to struggle with anxiety. Now, there's kind of a split there. Is that because the genetics of the parent passed on, that the parent themselves was self-medicating with alcohol, and the genetics just showed up in the children? Maybe. The other part of that is growing up around alcoholism is particularly difficult. There's an instability there. This is a long discussion that I don't have very often about what it's like to be around alcoholic parents, or an alcoholic partner in this case. There are many aspects of uncertainty that arise around alcoholism, where a person might be one way one moment and inexplicably a very different person another moment. It's not inexplicable. It's whether they're drunk or not, whether they're dealing with the after effects of alcohol or whether they're currently intoxicated. It's one of the worst environments for people with anxiety who really want consistency, stability, kind of a comprehensible world to be around. And unfortunately, it pairs. People with anxiety do find themselves around alcoholic people from time to time. And it's just particularly destructive. There's books written on this subject. Child of alcoholic adults, that kind of thing. There's support groups for this world. There's a lot of language that's evolved in psychology around this. We could talk for hours and hours on this subject alone. In the case of how this person phrased the question, I would say, yeah, you can't take this person's disease personally, and it certainly has nothing to do with you. And the guilt that we often add with our the guilt that we're adding by thinking that our stuff is impacting other people and maybe causing their bad choices, that's just baloney. People have to be responsible for their own choices, just like you have to be responsible for your own growth when it comes to anxiety. No one's causing it, and no one can solve it for you. And that's the same with the alcoholism. So can't spend forever on this question, but it's common in the sense that the two find themselves in company all the time. And yes, cognitively being around alcoholics takes a toll in particular. It takes a toll on everyone. But it takes a toll, in particular, on people with anxiety disorder.
Yeah, she never knows what's going to happen. I just found it so fascinating that she immediately goes to the fact that it's probably, she's probably a part of the problem.
Right.
Which
yeah,
is
and it,
highly unlikely, but,
yeah,
but that's where she's not. Gone.
Like I said, I ask everyone to take personal responsibility for their own choices, their own growth, their own issues. I don't really blame anybody for my anxiety. It was my challenge, and I have to face it. I'm the one who has to work through it, and if someone's struggling with alcohol abuse, loved ones can only do so much. Ultimately, we have to face our issues and do the hard work if we want to make change. So
it's a big thing. You get tied to somebody, and you make choices, and she wants to be dependent on him, and he's actually causing her more anxiety. Very a vicious circle. Okay.
It's a vicious circle, yeah, and somebody needs to make a big change, and I don't know what it would look like in that particular dynamic, but I can guarantee you that if he suddenly stops drinking for years, for the rest of his life, her anxiety doesn't automatically go away. And if she suddenly became a perfectly non-anxious person, his drinking doesn't suddenly go away.
No.
So at least we can start there and see what choices people make.
Okay. It's very frustrating that it seems like you actually have to completely fall apart before you get help. I've dealt with anxiety and depression for as long as I can remember. I hold a job and pay my bills. In appearance, I am pretty well put together. Inside, I'm a shambles. I'm scared of everyone, question if I even have the ability to trust, deal with hypervigilance and nightmares, unspecified guilt, and feelings of impending doom, yet somehow I manage to keep it all together because I'm all my daughter has.
Hmm. Yeah, you know, I can relate to that a lot, the idea of keeping up a certain exterior. There's a certain toll that we pay for that, by the way, and there's probably some false beliefs in there about how we have to look to the world. The idea that if we did share a little bit more honestly about what it feels like to be us, that all of a sudden everyone would leave us, we'd lose our job, whatever our catastrophic thoughts are, that's usually not the case, and it usually takes a fair bit of burden off of one of the first things we often work on cognitively is the idea of saying, okay, I'm not alone in this. My feelings aren't even all that unusual. There's millions and millions of people around me who struggle just like I do. It's slightly different in their own unique ways, but the basic fears are similar. Oh, big breath. This is kind of like the big picture of anxiety. The idea of having to get to a particular low point before we're willing to change. That comes up a lot. Very rarely do people end up working with me who haven't reached a certain low point. There's something, I'll just talk about myself. For me, there was kind of an ego, a thing that said, I can fix this, you know. Somehow I need to be strong, and admitting that I need help is maybe taking away that sense of strength that I felt I needed to grow through this. All I can say is that I needed to get pretty far down. The idea of change, whether it was taking medication or changing my life, changing my attitude, sharing with others, learning about this, gosh, there's so many things that I wouldn't have been willing to do unless things had gotten as bad as they were. Now, all that being said, it was all for nothing in the sense that I could have made those changes at any point. None of it was as scary as I thought, but... there's a certain power that comes from being really low. I often say things like, when you really start to question whether life is worth living, the way you feel, you become really open to those changes. All of a sudden, you know, the idea of continuing this way becomes bigger, more frightening than whatever fears you have around changing.
Yeah, we get calls from people who are ready to commit suicide, or their family say they are, and they change. I mean, they finally hit the very bottom and are desperate, and what's amazing is how fast they've been able to turn around.
Yes. I don't use the word suicidal. It's not quite the same. Very rarely are people actually saying, I am ready tomorrow to do this thing to end my life. They're saying, I cannot envision living this way. It has a suicidal tone to it, and it ends up being actually a source of strength where they say, okay, I am ready for change. I cannot keep living this way. I would rather die. So, yeah, the language sounds suicidal, but suicide very rarely surrounds this disorder.
I get the word from usually a relative or something. I'm afraid she's going to or he's going to.
Yep.
Yeah, they just tell me life isn't worth living anymore. I don't know what to do anymore.
Yeah. For as much as it's thought about by those of us who struggle, it happens very, very, very rarely. So that being said, I wish I could just tell everyone, make the change. It's not as bad as you think. Be more open with the people around you. Reach out for help. I hope to be a bit of a beacon and tell people, you know, I went through this and I made those decisions the hard way by getting to points like this. But in fact, all the fears that I had about how difficult it would be, how frightening it would be, didn't turn out to be as bad as I thought. Not even close.
Well, the man that I was talking about that called me this week to tell me his progress, the one that hadn't driven, and then he flew and drove and trained in front of an audience and set up the business. He was asked to work internationally, and the first thing I said was, well, does your company understand that you have anxiety disorder? And he said, oh, yes, they do. And I thought that was pretty amazing, because he went to his company and he told them, here are my limitations, here's what's happening, here's what I'm doing, here's what. And I think that gave him a lot of freedom.
Absolutely.
This lady is hiding it. She's hiding it from her daughter, she's hiding it from work, she hasn't reached out, she's terrified, she's stuck inside. And I think one of the reasons he made such quick progress was, okay, now my work knows, and here's what's going to happen. I'm willing to try. Makes a big difference.
Yeah, we all carry, I think of it as this big, heavy backpack that we carry, that this has to be my secret. And it's funny, you know, from both my mom and I's point of view, you know, we talk to people every day who struggle with this. And so we not only understand the statistics of how common it is, but we just talk to person after person after person after person. And it's funny that they each feel like they're alone, and they're ashamed, and that if anyone ever knew. And, there are people within the same family who don't share with each other, just simply because one believes the other would judge, wouldn't understand. And, in fact, here's two people who absolutely are struggling with the same exact thoughts. So we see all this from sort of a outside-the-box perspective. But being able to take that big burden off and being able to first share, and it could be with loved ones, family members, work, all these things, we just have to know that our brain is predisposed to think catastrophically and to kind of expect the worst outcome. And I can tell you, whatever your catastrophic expectation is, that's not what's going to happen. I don't know what it's like. I can't promise that every work will be as accommodating as this guy's work was, but I can say that it's not going to be as bad as you think. And usually the people who struggle are intelligent, articulate, hardworking, dedicated, conscientious, so many other features, and they're only focusing on their anxiety as if that's the only thing that defines them. And in this case, this guy's work sees a person who's wonderful, talented, and they're immediately ready to ship him off to become an international instructor.
I know.
And apparently he can do the work, and he's great at it, and that's often true, whether we're thinking of ourselves as an employee or as a partner in a relationship. we often only see our anxiety as if that's the only thing that defines us, and that's our big limitation, and that's all we're judged by. But we're in fact a lot of things, and the people who choose to be us or be with us, or the employers who choose to keep employing us, they see the big picture, and they see the whole thing, and man, there's a reason to have us around. So
yeah,
usually,
I mean, literally, this guy couldn't drive last year, so
right.
And so his work, I mean, knew all these limitations, and here he is flying, driving, training, setting up the entire business in another state, and they were willing to hang in with him. It's wonderful.
Well, and for very good reason.
Right.
You know, it may
right.
be difficult for him to see that in the mirror, but, you know, when I listen to people's big picture, I struggle to see my big picture, for the record. You know, I kind of feel the anxiety, and I go, you know, that's sort of my big defining feature, but that's just not true. I have a wonderful life. I've been employed. I've been my own employer. And, yeah, we're far more complicated than we often see when we're stuck in the middle of anxiety. So, just, yeah, I'll just stop there. You know, we have more questions to get to, but
yeah.
taking off that big burden of feeling alone, isolated, ashamed, that can be the most significant first step people take to their recovery.
And, you know, one thing is that she needs to deal with this because she has a daughter, and she's probably got a 50-50 chance that daughter may have a problem. And sometimes parents will do it for the child
mm-hmm.
rather than for
Something.
Themselves.
Yeah, when they,
you know, they
be
won't
willing
give
to
them,
do the work themselves.
Yeah, they can't give themselves permission to do this, but they can give themselves permission to learn so that their child won't suffer. Sometimes.
Yeah, in my case, I've got two kids, and one of them struggles, and had I not done the work that I did, learned the things I learned, I wouldn't be able to be a good coach for my son who struggles. So, yeah, there's a huge benefit
yeah,
there.
I wish somebody had helped me at that age because, you know, 42 years later, I had no definition of normal. I mean, I have no experience of being normal, and I couldn't draw from. I was so young, I didn't
right.
even know what I was looking for. Where now your son has great experiences, knows what's going on, and takes care of himself. Asks you for his nutrients, ups them. When he has a particular need, he already knows how to adjust him himself and
mm-hmm.
his blood sugar and all those things you've taught him. So he's got control. And, you know, as a kid, you feel like you're so out of control.
Right.
You just feel
yeah,
like...
Yeah, it was amazing to be able to tell him, okay, you know, he came to me one day when he was really struggling and he's, you know, he had that air of, I'm out of control. I don't understand how to fix this. And this is, you know, a 10-year-old. And I said, well, it's not as confusing as you think. It's connected to this and this and this, and here's how this. And, you know, we think it's difficult to coach children, but in fact, like the next day, he changed everything about his life as far as his diet and the nutrition and all the stuff that we work on with the Breakthrough Program. And he took to heart a lot of the cognitive stuff that I talked about. And he's like, I had the best day I've had in weeks. And that was just one day. You know, just having the knowledge and putting it to work. He felt great.
I think the mental burden was lifted for him, too, because he had stopped
yeah.
eating dinner and didn't know what was wrong. He was feeling sick all the time. And
yeah, I have to strike a balance. I want to be a family that would talk openly about anxiety, but it's not the focus. I don't want to model a bunch of anxious thinking, but I want it to be okay to talk about, no real shame and burden. And I think, you know, he sees me, you know, flying gliders and doing all this stuff that it doesn't really seem limited. I like, you know, going on this trip, you know, I just get up and go, you know, I go get on a plane with my wife and fly to Dallas. And there's really no talk about not being able to do something like that.
You just coached him, basically. Here's what we do. Here's why. And here's what we do. And so it wasn't, I hear and I see a lot of people writing sob stories, and they feel so sorry for themselves, and they get themselves in this big, big pile of poor me. But that's not how you approach it. It's like, okay, we have a job to do. here's what's happening, let's get it, the job done. And so here he was, 10 years old, now he's getting the job done. That's so different than just complaining and feeling sorry for yourself. And
well, but you know, like you growing up, you know, you didn't have this information.
I
it just
didn't.
Simply wasn't available to you. And that just shows how powerful either this knowledge is or not having it is. Your life spiraled downward, you know, in a way that you had the best intentions and I'm sure plenty of courage and effort, but without this information, you just couldn't fix yourself.
I sure couldn't. I didn't, I mean, I didn't know where to even begin. I just knew that I was strong. I didn't feel crazy. And that I was going to put one foot in front of each other every day. And that was the best I could do until finally we figured this out. Okay, I'm ready.
I know you want to get to the next question, but I'm curious. You know, if we look at the pattern, your grandfather, you know, had his life. We've talked about it before. No information, used drugs and alcohol, struggle. You know, you eventually got some information later in life, put it to work, sharing with others. I took that information to heart in my mid-20s, put it to work, sharing with others. My son's getting that information at 10, and I'm curious what his life can be like. What can he add to the puzzle? You know, what can he learn? What will he teach his kids? You know, that. I'm just curious to watch, you know, as I become the grandparent at some point. And I'm just curious to see that cycle continuing and how it grows.
Yes, it will be interesting to see what happens. I had an interesting experience yesterday, or moment. I went down to take care of my niece, who had her third round of chemo. She has really aggressive breast cancer. And I went down to clean and take care of the kids and work with her. And when I left, she'd had it on Wednesday. So it was only this. The bad days are coming. I'm probably going to go with her this weekend, too, and help them. So she gets like five, it just progressively gets worse and worse until she's completely down tomorrow, probably Sunday, Monday, she may start getting better. But anyway, as I left, she hugged me and told me she loved me, and she said, "You are such a great caretaker." And I said, "Well, I love to do that." And she said, "You should have been a doctor." And I said, "I know." And I said, "But I couldn't. You know, there's no way that I could have gone through school with anxiety disorder. There was just no way I could be a doctor. So the closest thing I came to was being, you know, having my husband become a doctor. But I, you know, that my life, that part of my life was stopped. No matter how much I wanted that to be what I was going to do in my life. But I don't think that that would stop your son now. I think it's possible that if that was what he wanted to do, he could do it.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, it's a pretty crazy system they have. I don't know that I advise anybody to go through that and stay up 72 hours all the crazy things they have to do. But
yeah, it's almost like they've designed a system that weeds out anybody who has anxiety disorder. The odds of having a doctor at any level that really understands what we've gone through is pretty low. And I think that's kind of held back the knowledge, the growth, the teaching in the medical field. And I don't know if the medical community has really stopped and acknowledged that as a limitation of their method. But
I can tell you they haven't, because I have a friend who is a medical doctor, and she has a program that she started in the United States, well, everywhere. She's even spoken to President Obama about the huge number of suicides in the medical profession. Two of her boyfriends from medical school have already committed suicide, and they just see too much, and they're forced to do too much, and they start out caring, but there's no room for caring in this, you know, in the process. They just make you a zombie doing your job, and so these people feel overwhelmed and frustrated, and here they wanted to be helpful, and they can't stand to watch people suffering. So she has a movement going. She has retreats going for these doctors because they are redefining how their practice is going to be and how they're going to help people. It'll be interesting to see how much she's had several TED Talks and been recognized. So we'll see. I hope that the schoolings and the whole profession changes the way they train doctors. I hope there's more women. I hope they have more regular schedules so they can have a family life and sleep. We'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
She's trying to make a huge stink and a huge change in the world. Okay, ready for the next question?
I am.
I am 22. I'm struggling with a lack of motivation. I would happily spend the day in bed with my curtains closed. I feel that no one quite understands me. My partner takes it as I'm lazy. Simple chores such as going to the post office I'll put off due to anxiety. And again, called lazy. I'm on medication for depression, which is where my anxiety stems from. Feeling a bit lost as my partner gets angry and throws the, you're putting it on. Those are his words. There's nothing wrong with you. Oh, card at me. How can I help him understand?
Well, you know, kind of getting back to that alcohol question, you know, we ultimately have to do the hard work. Having a partner understand who hasn't experienced depression, which is really kind of the leading feature of this question, is going to be tough. And I don't know if I'd wish it on anyone. I don't know if I could ever really have a heart-to-heart with someone who's never experienced a panic attack about what it's really like. It's even with all my practice with this, it's a very difficult thing to explain to someone. That being said, you know, it's a she. Did we catch that?
I think it's a she. And she does say that it's due to anxiety, though. So
yes.
She's saying this depression. Did she even mention the word depression? I don't think so.
She didn't. She's on medication for depression.
Oh,
it
that's right. Yes, she does. So,
yeah. So, okay. Kind of back to basics, we can say definitively that people who experience chronic anxiety are more likely to experience depression. I view it as sort of a mental fatigue issue that after we experience enough chronic anxiety, features of depression start to creep in. And depression is this big catch-all term. It can mean what we're describing here, kind of staying in bed. I'm kind of the opposite. I get sort of agitated and I just can't. I'm tired, but yet I couldn't sleep. I'm, you know, my version has a little different twist to it. Trying to describe all the different variations of depression would take a while. But the recovery process is the same. We would put good dietary strategies, the breakthrough program. We would put exercise back in place. We would probably structure a few life things where we would wake up and have some lists. And it can be shocking how different the brain chemistry can be if we've just change that first hour, let's say, of every day and have some different strategies about how we're going to get out of bed at a particular time and to go through a ritual. And it could be both for the depression specifically, specific forms of exercise, and the anxiety, whether that's breathing, meditation, things like that. And then carry that energy forward just from that shift, that 1 hour of shift, and then see how we can do that first errand. See how we can do that second thing and knock down problems as they come up, whether they're specific anxiety with specific kind of events throughout the day, those we would face kind of one at a time and work on them. There's this sense in questions like this that I'm down here at a zero and, you know, life seems to be up here at a seven or an eight. And I just, you know, I can't just go from a zero to an eight. That's just never going to happen. You know, I tried to take this medication. It really didn't do a lot. And that's just not how this process works. We get these little footholds, these little toe holds, and we take advantage of them. We push ourselves up a little higher. And it seems like a bunch of work for very little gain, and then all of a sudden we reach a tipping point where each thing we do gives us more energy to keep going. And our circle, as I talked about earlier, starts to grow. And so it's my job, because I've seen this, you know, dozens or hundreds and hundreds of times, to have that confidence going through this, that even though the first steps feel like a lot of work for not a lot of reward, to know that maybe even just a few weeks away, we're going to reach a tipping point where we really start to start growing to start expanding, to start seeing the possibility of where our lives can go to.
Oh, sorry about my fax going off.
Oh, no, it's understandable.
I can't stop that one. One of the things, depression takes longer than the anxiety. And nutritionally, we know that nerve cells take longer, brain cells take longer to repair themselves. So you're just going to, physiologically, you're going to take longer. We also, as part of the program, work with the gut. And the gut is oftentimes referred to as the mini brain. So it has the same chemistry. It has, Josh, you probably know more, serotonin, all kinds of things are in the gut, the same as in the brain. And so we start working on the gut, and then eventually we start working on repairing the brain cells. And so you're working on the cognitive part, and the Break Free program is working on the cells, and the cells take a certain amount of time to turn over, repair, and then they need to turn over again and make new healthy cells. So there's just time that it takes to make those repairs physically.
That being said, yes, it does take time. And, yeah, there's a lot of curious research to show that some of the things in the Break Free program, even though they might not seem to directly impact depression, are actually more powerful than these frontline antidepressant medications that we see out there. Those studies exist, and they're continuing to look into them. The challenge is always that, at least we here in America, we like to spend a bunch of money on research that will produce a drug that we can charge a bunch of money for, and researching things like the gut bacteria, that's probably not going to ever lead to a drug that's going to be worth $5 a pill. We know what those bacteria are. So it's tough to get the research, but peer research schools are still continuing to do it. And, yeah, so the questions you were getting at, that mini brain idea, our gut has about 90% of the serotonin in our body. That's just how it signals. And there does appear to be a connection between gut health and just about any other form of health, whether that's coronary heart disease or depression. And that just seems so unexpected, the way we think about the body, that something as distant as our stomach, or in this case our small and large intestine bacteria, could have any impact on the way our brain cells organize, the way our attitude, mood, thinking, energy is. That just doesn't seem like that would be that likely, but it's proving to be true. And further research just keeps supporting that. So,
yeah, and they're becoming the specific products we use seem to be the ones that are specifically directed or helpful for anxiety and depression. So, and then there's the fact that a lot of people can't pick up their B vitamins if they don't have their probiotics. And so, you're just going down this rabbit hole where you have a collapse in one area. And so we know that when you're missing your B vitamins, you definitely have mental disorders. They're not really, to me, mental disorders, but they put them in the category, the types of thinking and symptoms when the B vitamins are missing. And so we put whole food B vitamins back in them rather than synthetic B. Oh, that's all. I guess I could get carried away on that one. Synthetic nutrients are not the same. They are not close to what nature intended. They don't have the factors and cofactors around them. The B vitamins, as a matter of fact, we know there are 24. The most you can get generally at the store is 8 synthetic B vitamins. So, and chemically, synthetic usually does not match up to the chemical ones that are in your body. Vitamin C is particularly, I think, Josh, you did chemistry. One is right and left-handed. And
oh, my God, yes, the twist on molecules. I don't know how complicated a discussion we want to have here, but yes.
Synthetic C is not the same as natural C in foods. Even though they say it is, it's not. Chemically.
Yeah, you think you take your carbon and hydrogen or whatever and link it together, and you think you've made a drug, But if you think about it, like Lego blocks, they can either organize to one direction or another. You can think of it as right-handed or left-handed, sort of
right.
like clockwise or counterclockwise. And as odd as it sounds, clockwise or right-handed, as we tend to call it, in chemistry can be perfectly healthy, and left-handed can be actually poisonous. Even though in the lab, chemically, all the blocks are where they're supposed to be. What was that drug? You would have known about it. They tried to give pregnant women.
Oh, yes. I know what you're talking about. It was my era, and then the kids were left with...
Yeah,
it started
horrible
with a B,
birth defect.
I think. Oh, no, it was thalidomide. Thalidomide.
And so
they,
it turns out...
No arms and legs.
I can't remember whether it's right-handed or left-handed, but that was the error. If they were able to produce it correctly in the correct sort of chemical, literally the physical structure... it was wonderful. It was fine. But in the chemical process, the synthesizing process, a lot of it was the other direction, and it became highly, highly, what would we call it, teratogenic, birth defect causing, bad, bad, bad. And, yeah, we just didn't even understand that synthesizing.
They thought they made the same thing as in nature, but
they did.
They missed this little
they
tiny
didn't.
Thing that nature knew best. So,
if you're curious, there's a whole radio lab. Episode. It's an NPR thing here in the States. Radiolab did it, and I can't remember what it's called. It looks, I know, at Alice in Wonderland a little bit, and the idea of right-handed and left-handed chemicals, and you kind of can dig into this and get kind of some basic information. So for a long time, people have been questioning whether synthesized vitamins would do the same thing. And synthesized C, ascorbic acid, will prevent the big thing that plague Western civilization, which was scurvy.
Right.
So, right, that's where, you know, we get this huge validation that synthesized vitamins will work. But then when we dig deeper, it turns out that's true for scurvy, but not true for many, many other things.
Right.
And if you can, get your nutrients from whole sources. In a perfect world, we all have organic, wonderful nutrients, vegetables, everything. And we get none of it through a pill, but we don't live in that world, not even close. And so, you know, my mom works tirelessly to make sure she does the best she can with what's out there.
Yeah, what's out there. It is 1:03 p.m. I'm going to unmute
okay.
everybody and say goodbye, and we will see everybody next Tuesday. If anybody wants to say goodbye or anything, they're welcome to get on the line. Otherwise... you and Kelly have a fun day today, I hope.
Yeah, I'm going to go down and learn about vascular disease. I'll sit in
oh.
Yeah, I'll
well,
learn
about
all the technology. And yeah, I'm one of those people that doesn't mind sitting in on any kind of conference of pretty much any kind and just learn. And so yesterday I got to tour all the latest imaging technology, which was really neat. These very wealthy companies have these models, these men that come in and they scan them. Because all the sonogram women are women. All the sonogram people are predominantly women. So there's these little male models and they're scanning their hearts and they're scanning their legs. And it was cool. It was cool to see all the technology that goes into what my wife does, which is scanning veins and arteries for all kinds of different blockages and issues. So, yeah, I'll go sit in and learn about the latest grafting techniques where they put in synthetic tubing to replace veins.
I find that fascinating too, Josh. I just get so, you know, I love medicine. I love health. I love the whole thing. So I don't blame you. I find that, you know, I'd just as soon go into surgery and watch as anything.
Yeah, I'm a little more blood and guts than my wife is. I would prefer to be more in the surgical suite. She tends to scan people on the outside. This is one big lesson downstairs about why you should keep your vascular health in order, kind of a fringe benefit of the Breakthrough Program and just to the general health that comes with it. I mean, it's just about everything I end up recommending for people helps overall health, not just anxiety
right.
and depression. And, man, you know, when she comes to me and talks about what happens when you let an artery in your vein completely occlude or block, the kinds of disease that sets off and seeing people getting their limbs, amputated, just absolutely horrible stuff.
I know.
And
she sees some pretty stuff,
so
tough stuff.
Even if you don't want to fix your anxiety or depression, man, stay on top of your health.
Yeah.
Stay, you know, keep some motion in your life. If you can get smoking out of your life, good. you know, watch what you eat. Lots of, you know, all the stuff I end up teaching. You know, I don't care if my kids ever get anxiety disorder if they just stay healthy. Use the stuff, the same things that I teach everyone for anxiety and depression. Will do a great job of keeping you healthy in the long run.
Absolutely. It's a great health program for everybody. Well, I'm going to go. I have lots of work this afternoon. I have to make a delivery to someone who just had a hip replacement and is doing excellently, but the doctor won't let her drive yet. So I'm going to go take her nutrients to her so she can recover a little faster. So everybody, have a good day. And
let me just close on this. I teach this a lot, which is that when you choose to grow, whatever that is, you take that step and, you know, cross that bridge or take that flight, there's often these strange rewards on the other side, and I've never been able to fully understand that. There's these really profound experiences a lot of us have doing these relatively mundane things for other people, but for us it's really significant. And for me, you know, I do really well, but getting on an airplane, you know, it's still, you know, a little anxiety producing, and having the courage to go do a medical seminar trip with my wife, you know, it's still there. And we just happened to stagger outside this morning, and right outside our hotel room is where JFK was shot. And to walk down those streets and stand there and know that American history turned at this moment, just a profound experience.
I bet.
And I'm probably going to walk back. There's literally an X in the center of the street where the bullet struck him. And you can look up to the building where Lee Harvey Oswald was, and you can just see the whole scene, and there's a really powerful JFK memorial. Where I guess we'd call it, and to just sit, and I appreciate the fact that I get to experience these things, and that I'm the kind of person that has the sensitivity and awareness and intelligence to kind of process, I think, at a more deeper level than most of the people around me. It's meaningful, so I value the fact that I have these experiences tremendously.
Someone just drove up, if you can tell. So I've got to hang up. The dogs are going nuts.
All right.
Talk to you later. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye, everyone.
The moderator has left the conference. The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.